Hello, Study Fam. It's nice to have you back. We're going to follow up this last week's episode where we talked about Jewish thought on the afterlife with an episode about grief, loss, and bereavement. My friend Lo actually specifically requested this episode, and we thought it would be nice to talk about what happens when we lose someone. It's been a time of immeasurable loss, and as you'll come to hear, Judaism actually has a lot to offer when it comes to rituals around mourning. I'm going to cut this intro short today because before we get into this episode itself and open up the Torah and Parshat Chukat, before we speak with the incredibly brilliant Professor Simon Shimshon Rubin, who is the director at the International Laboratory for the Study of Loss, Bereavement, and Human Resilience, author of multiple brilliant books, which we'll talk about, and chairman of the Zramim Postgraduate Program in Psychotherapy at the University of Haifa. I wanted Rabbi Matt to give us a brief primer on some of the Jewish practices surrounding loss. So here he is.
So Jewish mourning practices are probably among the most famous practices in Judaism, and yet also some of the most mysterious. Many of us have heard of the idea of sitting Shiva, or Shiva, which literally means seven. It refers to the first 7 days after a loved one is buried. Not 7 days after death, but actually after their funeral. And during those 7 days, all of the primary mourners, which is to say parents, siblings, children, and partners of the deceased, will traditionally gather in the home of the person who died, or more frequently will gather in a home of one person in that family, some kind of home that is big enough to accommodate everyone, and they will just camp out there. They'll basically stay there for 7 days. And there are a few traditions that accompany that idea of Shiva. As they wait there in that house, there is typically a minyan, a service that happens 3 times a day in traditional settings that will allow for the mourner's Kaddish to be spoken. And the mourner's Kaddish, of course, is the traditional Aramaic text that mourners recite, typically for a year if they're mourning someone very close to them or traditionally a parent. I'll say more about that year-long unit of time in just a second. But the other thing about saying the mourner's Kaddish is that typically a minyan, meaning at least 10 people, is required to say it. And so people will come to a house of mourning, will attend a Shiva minyan, you may have heard of, in order for there to be that minimum of 10 people so that the people mourning can say this text of the mourner's Kaddish. And typically it's more than just 10 people. Often if you're invited to a minyan or a Shiva, someone you know is sitting Shiva, it's customary to go pay your respects, to just check in on your loved one who is mourning someone important to them. And one kind of curious thing that people might not think about is that you're not really supposed to speak to someone in mourning before they speak to you. You can go to their house or go to this house of mourning, the Shiva house, and make yourself known, but you typically let them speak first, which is a way of honoring the mourner and whatever's going on for them, sort of letting them call the shots and set the stage for what that conversation will be like. So in some ways, I suppose that's a very practical thing for those of you out there who hear about a Shiva, want to attend a Shiva, but don't know what to say. One of the beautiful things about Shiva is that you don't have to say anything at all, because it's really hard to confront someone when they're in mourning. The last thing to say about Shiva is that typically, as a family is there in that house for 7 days, it's customary to bring food, or you can bring whatever you want, but often people will bring food to ensure that that family has their needs taken care of. And there are a number of other rituals in Shiva that have to do with a mourner demonstrating their grief. So typically they'll sit closer to the ground on lower stools as opposed to comfortable chairs, and typically they won't wear leather, kind of like on Yom Kippur, as a symbol of their humility and the pain of what's going through their minds, of what they're experiencing during Shiva. So that's the first 7 days. And after those 7 days, typically a person in mourning will then walk around the block. They'll leave the Shiva home, marking the end of that 7-day period. Then they get to a 30-day period of mourning called Shloshim. And during that time, they're able to leave their home, but they don't do things like listening to celebratory music or attending parties or anything that's overly festive. And if in a traditional setting you are mourning your sibling, your child, or your partner, it's that 30-day period that will complete your traditional mourning ritual. But in a traditional setting, if you are mourning a parent, then the mourning process continues actually for a year. And during that year, a person in mourning is supposed to say the mourner's kaddish for their parent every single day, traditionally 3 times a day, at a minyan, right, at one of these services. So this idea of a year comes from essentially something very practical, which is that any of you listeners who have lost someone probably know that when you experience something for the first time without a loved one, it can be very challenging. And so the year offers us a cycle of every holiday and every season that we might encounter without a loved one. And after that year, you've gone through the cycle. You've had a first Passover without a loved one. You've had a first high holidays without your loved one. And so then it allows you then to move on beyond that experience. And what I've just presented is basically the traditional way of doing things. But I should say that that's only one way of doing things. Many contemporary American Jews don't do all of those traditional rituals. It's customary probably in reform settings like I find myself in to do not a full week of Shiva, but a couple days, or perhaps to have a week, but not to have a minyan 3 times a day or something like that. But I will say that despite the fact that it's less and less common to do the full week and then 30-day period of mourning, there is some kind of mystery and magic to these rituals of mourning. And I invite any of us to consider, if we are in mourning, if we've lost someone, I invite us to consider how to take these traditional rituals, the rubric that I just mentioned, and try to find some other way of ritualizing a person whom we loved as a way of then moving on after we lose them.
Well, thank you so much for helping us set the stage. If someone is dealing with mourning, is it customary for them to go to their rabbi for guidance through that time? Is that kind of the rigmarole?
Absolutely. And if you are in mourning or someone you know is in mourning, please feel free to reach out to literally any rabbi of any denomination. Some people feel anxious, like, oh, I'm not a member of a synagogue, but that doesn't matter. It's really up to rabbis to be there for anybody who's suffering and anyone in need.
There you have it. Make sure to give us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Throw us some spare change to keep the lights on at patreon.com/thestudy. Say hi on Twitter @study_show and tell a friend. Okay, on to the show. So happy to welcome back as my co-host, Rabbi Matt Green, joining us from Brooklyn, New York. Welcome, Rabbi Matt.
I'm really glad to be here again, Raviv.
And today we are in conversation with Professor Emeritus of Clinical Psychology at University of Haifa School of Psychological Sciences, author of Working with the Bereaved, Multiple Lenses on Loss and Mourning, and director at the International Laboratory for the Study of Loss, Bereavement, and Human Resilience. Joining us from Israel, Professor Simon Shimshon Rubin. It is an honor to speak with you today.
Good day to all.
You know, last week through the lens of Parshat Korach, we were able to discuss Jewish concepts of afterlife. And this week in Parsha Chukat, we've got a lot of death and dealing with loss. So we thought it might be nice to follow up last week with a conversation about what happens to the people left behind. Rabbi Matt, I'm wondering if you'd be so kind to give us a summary of what we encounter in this week's Torah portion to set us off in the right direction.
Absolutely. In some ways, Parshat Chukat is filled with important pieces of plot in the Torah. And because it's a summertime Torah portion, many people don't know it very well because usually they're away on vacation or at summer camp or who knows where. But Parashat Chukat is in some ways not only important because of all of the plot, but because it focuses on death. It begins in Numbers 19 by focusing on the ritual of the red heifer, which is one of these very strange, obscure mitzvot, these commandments that we find about what to do if you've come into contact with a corpse. If you, as a regular Israelite, have come into contact with a dead body, there are things you need to do to purify yourselves. And we get this concept of a sacrifice of a full brown cow that is supposed to help Israelites purify themselves after that. But after chapter 19, which is fully focused on that ritual of purification, we get chapter 20, where really the important plot points occur. Because right at the beginning, we learn that Miriam, Moses' sister, dies. And the text is very terse about it. In fact, it doesn't say very much at all. It just says, Vatamot sham Miriam, Vatika versham, meaning Moses died there and was buried there. Full stop. That's all we hear. And then immediately thereafter, the people get very upset, but it's not necessarily connected to her. They get upset because they don't have any more water. And so this has led many rabbinic commentaries to focus on Miriam's unique role in Israelite life as being a bearer of water or someone connected to a mythic well from which the Israelites drank their water. And immediately thereafter, because the people are upset, God instructs Moses on what to do to give the people water. But Moses gets very upset and can't deal with the complaining of the Israelites, as has happened many times. And so despite God's specific instructions, Moses actually hits a rock from which forth water springs. But because he doesn't do exactly what God wanted him to do, God punishes him by saying he will no longer get to enter the promised land. So that, by the way, is a pretty important part of the plot, and it happens right here in this parsha. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, but immediately almost after that episode with the rock and the water, Aaron, Moses' brother, also dies. And Aaron's death is presented with much more fanfare. Aaron, you may recall, is the high priest, the first high priest of ancient Israel. And so when he dies, toward the end of chapter 20, there are many more verses. But specifically, we learn, Vayivku et Aharon shloshim yom kol beit Yisrael, meaning the people, all of the house of Israel, wailed for Aaron. They cried, they mourned for Aaron. And we get the first instance there then of mourning, not in the Torah, but in this family of these Levites of Moses, this family. They didn't mourn, as far as we can tell, for Miriam, but they did mourn for 30 days when it comes to Aaron. And then the parsha goes on with another chapter talking about all kinds of military victories that perhaps we don't need to talk about here. But chapter 20 in this week's Torah portion is really focused on death in all sorts of ways.
We've got two very different versions of reacting to death here. One is moving on and being angry about something else when Miriam dies. And then, like you say, the fanfare of mourning around Aaron. What do you make of these different responses to such significant deaths in Torah?
Well, one thing that's pretty obvious, we just need to say it, is that the Torah does tend to focus more on men than women. And this has already happened between Miriam and Aaron in the past, that the Torah, for instance, when both Miriam and Aaron in an earlier parsha complain about Moses and Moses' wife, Zipporah, it's only Miriam who gets punished. That doesn't seem so fair. So already we've seen in the Torah plenty of examples of misogyny, let's say, with lots of love for the Torah. We can say that. It may just be that the Torah cares more about men than women. But one piece that is obvious too is that Aaron is the high priest of Israel. So for Aaron to die, it could create lots of problems, right? So much of the Torah is devoted to setting up the priesthood and the temple and all this stuff. Aaron was a central piece of that puzzle. And so his death perhaps could be more significant, but still, we're left wondering, what's going on with this Miriam situation? Why is it just one, really two phrases in one verse that is devoted to her death? And I would throw out one other piece, which is why I mentioned this stuff about Moses hitting the rock, which is that even though the Torah doesn't say much about the reaction of the people to to Miriam's death, we can imagine, and many commentators go on to say, that Moses' behavior, hitting this rock, getting angry at the people and then hitting the rock against God's command, was in some ways his own personal response to the death of his sister. that he was so torn up inside that he wasn't thinking right. Perhaps because he didn't have a proper mourning ritual. Who knows? But there is a lot to say about the word that Moses uses when he condemns the people in that moment. He calls them morim, meaning rebellious ones. And that word is connected to Miriam, perhaps. So many commentators make that connection there too.
I've heard a commentary that says the skip straight to the lack of access to water could perhaps be the Israelites' inability to access tears, which might mean inability to deal with mourning, like you say, if we don't have a way to do that yet. Professor Rubin, I'm wondering if any of these responses resonate with you or what your take is on these two very different versions of dealing with death here.
Well, although you had promised me I wouldn't need to read the chapter, the Torah verses, I sort of took the liberty of preparing for next week's Torah reading this past Shabbat. So at least I would have an idea of what you guys were going to be talking
Fantastic.
About. What we're really seeing, I think, at this point in the Torah narrative in Bamidbar is the last year of the 40-year journey in the desert. And the people who led the Jewish people, Moses and Aaron and Miriam, in their own ways, are really leaving the stage at this point. And then a new leadership is needed, a different kind of leadership is needed. And certainly from a overview of looking at this journey that has gone on for so long, and these leaders have been so familiar to the people, but actually the Israelites who left Egypt, who did not opt to go into Israel when the spies came back, they're all dying. So this whole generation is really dying, and with it, their leaders. And so what we're seeing almost is the beginning of the end for one generation and moving forward to the transfer of the mantle of leadership to Joshua. From a public point of view, certainly people have grown up with a certain kind of leadership, and here we're in a week of transition in Israel, with Mr. Netanyahu stepping down or being moved out and someone new coming in. For a lot of people, that's very difficult, irrespective of what you may think of the previous prime minister or the new prime minister. It's a big change. He's been prime minister now for 12 years. And many people who have reached maturity have never known any other leader. So this is difficult. There's something about death in a family, even when people are dying and they're not young, but they're the patriarchs and the matriarchs of a family, that can really be unsettling and scary for folks in different ways. The previous patriarch is gone, and the next generation steps up to become the patriarch. The matriarch is gone, the next generation becomes the matriarch, and this is an important transition. I think that the fact that these are three siblings who are in this year going to pass away together, Miriam and Aaron in this portion of the reading, and Moses at the end of Deuteronomy, when he's basically allowed to glimpse but not to enter the promised land, their connections start in Exodus. But Miriam is basically the one who has cared for Moses, made sure that he was picked up by the daughter of Pharaoh and protected. Her role for him has been incredibly dramatic. The thing about when the Torah tries to contrast the relationship of siblings in Exodus of Aaron and Moses to the relation of siblings throughout Genesis, where there's a great deal of tension, murder and violence, starting with Cain and Abel, and just the all the siblings are usually at it in different ways. When Exodus rolls around, you have these two brothers who are like one. Moses and Aaron are considered to be, they complete each other, they speak for each other. There's such a deep sibling connection there. So you have these three siblings who are incredibly connected in a family way, who have such respect and love and interweaving, I think, of their relationship. The fact that two of them pass away and really leaving Moses bereft and alone in a way that he's never been before is certainly quite dramatic. And one of the things about bereavement, certainly for older siblings or younger siblings who lose their connection, the people who are their generation, who experienced the parents above them in a kind of a cohort, those are very painful kinds of losses. And in Judaism, we mark them very differently than we mark a loss of a parent. And one of the things about Judaism's lovely and very sensitive mourning rituals are that they're most accurately, I would say, intuitively in tuned to the loss of a parent. And they're, I would say, in the modern era, certainly psychologically, they're much less attuned to the loss of a sibling or the loss of a child. 11-month mourning ritual is staying at the Kaddish, which in the Orthodox circles is making something that more and more women are taking on, at least in the modern Orthodox tradition. So that these are ways to go into the synagogue, to memorialize, to say the Kaddish prayer, which basically says that we reaffirm God's majesty, which is not a prayer about the dead or for the dead, but it is something that we remind ourselves that there is a, perhaps in a religious point of view, that we're all part of a master plan. This is God's master plan. And that as painful and as hard as it may be to lose somebody we care for, we do not lose sight of God and his or her master plan for all of us. But the sibling mourning ritual is 30 days for loss of a child. It's again 30 days, although it's much more difficult, I think, for psychologically at least, for most people to come to grips with what it's like to lose a child as opposed to losing a parent. But the ritual, as sensitive as the psychological features of mourning ritual can be in Judaism, I think it's not only about sensitivity and psychological meanings, it's also about a master plan, a way of looking at things that is embedded in a narrative and in a mix of Jewish law, ritual, custom, that has got additional agendas besides bringing people together and supporting them.
I really appreciate that. And you mentioned bereavement in your book, Working with the Bereaved, Multiple Lenses on Loss and Mourning. You lay out a pretty evolved framework regarding emotional and intellectual assumptions about loss and bereavement. I'm wondering, just to set the stage, if you could help us define the word bereavement.
The Merriam-Webster dictionary that I quote in with some other colleagues on a recent article talks about it as losing something, but in most ways speak about it, we're talking about it as loss of somebody to death. And the I believe the old English is to be robbed, so that you are, it is something that is stolen from you. You are bereaved, robbed of something that's incredibly important. The reason that my colleagues and I were discussing what the word might mean is because we were looking to understand what it's like to lose the psychological personhood of a family member to Alzheimer's or dementia, where their physical being continues and yet their psychological existence and the person they had been for you recedes and really dies off. And we're trying to understand how those are similar and different to being robbed of people who pass away very clearly and cleanly. Coming from Israel, I'll say a few things, if you don't mind, about what it's like to be a bereavement expert from Israel in different places in the world. And people are always saying, well, you're an expert on bereavement because in Israel there's so much terror and there's so many losses and so many wars. I say, yeah, I understand all that, but actually everybody dies. And every culture, it's 100% death rate. So we may have an additional amount of loss that is off time, that it's younger people dying perhaps, and not the, we hope to be dying of old age and the generations passing on in an orderly and pleasant fashion. Painful it might be psychologically, but it is not quite as scary or earth-shaking for people as to lose somebody in their beginning of their life or in the full power of their mature existence. But I also say that what I try to remind people is there's really no correct way to grieve and mourn. There's such a tremendous variation between individuals, between cultures, between religions, and even within the same religion and same culture, the psychological experience, moving from a relationship with somebody who was with you physically in this world and really helping it transition to having a psychological, emotional connection to somebody who is inside of you. And depending on your way of thinking about what happens to people's souls after they pass away, you can also think of that in many different ways. And Judaism certainly has has dealt with that in the idea of a continuation of the soul. But you can be a 100% atheist and not believe in that at all, and yet there is some transformation that goes from being in a relationship with somebody who was with you to somebody who's not. The three of us now are looking at each other on Zoom. We are not with anybody else, as far as I can tell, in the room, and we are not grieving for anybody that's not in the room with us right now. But we're not in contact with them. They're distant from us, and we're really pretty much fine with that. At the same time, when people get messages, a telegram comes in or a push message comes in and says that your best whatever has just passed away, despite the fact that you're not in physical connection with them, you will enter into a phase of dealing with a loss, the death of somebody incredibly important to you, and there will be a psychological process that accompanies that information. I often give examples of people who may have emigrated from London to Christchurch or Dunedin or Auckland, and the Great War or the Second World War occurs, and years go by, and then they get a letter 6 years later saying that so-and-so had died 6 years before. And they hadn't had contact, not a single bit of information for 6 years, and they're fine. But then they get this information and they begin to grieve and they begin to mourn. So it's clearly something within us, between ourselves and within ourselves, that responds to loss and to death. And how that occurs and what that means is tricky. I think oftentimes I've been with people who say, well, how was so-and-so at the funeral? How did they respond? And you can say, oh, they were terribly broken up, or they really seemed to be in control of their emotions, or they were comforting somebody else, or they were being comforted. And you give this very external point of view of what it was like looking from the outside, but the psychological inner experience of what it was like for them at the funeral and in the Shiva, the 7 days traditional comforting that we have, you really don't know what's going on within people. And what I can say as a researcher and as a clinician who works with people who've experienced losses is that a lot of times people don't want to know that it's a really difficult emotional experience to ask somebody how they're feeling and to be open to listening. And a lot of people learn to shut down, especially when it comes to parents who've lost kids. They're very threatening. When it comes to people who've lost a loved one to suicide, they're considered to be somehow a harbinger or not a messenger, perhaps, but somebody that reminds us that terrible things can happen. And people really want to feel safe by saying, well, this happened to them for some reason. And the flip side of that is people say, well, this happened to me for some reason, and then they sometimes will blame themselves or seek out different things. A lot of people learn to hide their pain and learn to hide what they're really feeling because they understand how uncomfortable it makes other people. And when you walk in as a true friend and are willing to listen, don't have to be a clinician, but if you come as a researcher and ask people to tell you their story, they are just incredibly touched and pleased in a human contact way that they can share what's going on for them. So if I can, for a second, jump back to the Torah portion, you have these two leaders who've just lost their sister, Moses and Aaron, and well, how should the people respond? Should the people give them their space as grieving siblings, or should the leaders understand that their role transcends their personal feelings, that they're in a position of leadership, that they don't have the human luxury of grieving because they're in charge of people who are perhaps terrified that Miriam and her well have disappeared. They're worried and that they don't have the luxury of being open to their feelings. And some of the commentaries also that I noted when I was looking at the different responses were saying, well, the people should have given Moses and Aaron more space and they should have been comforting to them. And other people say, well, Moses and Aaron's sin was that they didn't understand how much responsibility they had, and they didn't have the luxury of being able to open up to their emotions. And therefore the anger that slipped out or came out was a failure on their responsibilities. And I think all of us in families, when there's young children, perhaps, that need to be cared for and comforted, that I think every parent who's lost a partner understands that they're in this tremendous, perhaps, grief. And at the same time, they have some responsibility to assist particularly younger children in dealing with this thing. So there's something about leadership that you don't need to be the leader of the Jewish people in the desert. You can be just an important person in your own family at every role, child, parent, grandparent, and that there's our concern, our own pain, and also our interconnectedness, which is why we're grieving, because we lost somebody we're connected to. But we also have interconnectedness with other people in our family. So it gets to be complicated.
There are so many things that you said that I want to ask you about. But I think just to pick up on that piece, the fact that perhaps Moses and Aaron were grieving themselves or, you know, didn't know how to do that, but also perhaps the people were grieving as well. I mean, if you're using this family systems comparison, there is a situation which everyone is grieving and yet the leaders still have to lead. And that kind of reminds me of the past year and change of this pandemic, where our leaders are expected to respond to the pandemic and have all the answers, and yet they themselves as human beings are also responding to the pandemic. And it could be the pandemic, it could be some great national tragedy, it could be really anything. But I think that's really relatable the way that you're talking about it. And it seems among the things that Moses and Aaron, or let's say Moses, let's say, doesn't do right, it seems that he doesn't give himself the space to grieve, or whether it's the people don't give him that space or the people don't give him that space. And it's clear that there isn't a clearly defined ritual for him yet, right? We'll have books and books worth of rituals in Judaism that emerge, but there's not yet a clearly defined way for him to do that, perhaps. So I wonder if you might speak about the role of ritual itself. When we get this idea of 30 days and Shloshim, which comes from this week's Torah portion, that's a kind of ritual that we now have as modern Jews. But whether it's in a Jewish context or in a non-Jewish context, what is the role of ritual in the grieving process?
One of the things that I and many of my colleagues in the clinical world who work with individuals and families who've lost people is how much we're inspired by many traditions and many cultures' way of doing things. And that when people are modern and secular and they have moved away from the traditional mourning practices that at least we know of in Judaism, they are sometimes totally bereft of rituals. The kibbutzim in Israel in the 40s and 50s, they were remaking what it means to be Jewish, to be secular. And the idea was that somebody died in the morning, you buried them, and then you went back to work because we don't do these ritual things anymore. We're making a new kind of culture. They have certainly moved far away from that. The kibbutzim have moved far away from what it was. But originally it was an idea that, well, we can do away with ritual. We don't need it. We don't believe in it. And what they discovered was that ritual is incredibly valuable for assisting people in who are grieving themselves, for allowing the community to meet with them in a sort of a formalized encounter that allows for tremendous connection and contact. In Judaism, we place a great deal of emphasis on accompanying the body to burial. The rabbinic tradition as well, if you have any ability to attend a funeral, you should, because it really gives connection and respect for the person who died, and also gives comfort and solace to a certain extent for the families and the members who are left behind. It's just helpful many times for people to walk into a situation where they are sort of guided in what to do, whether it's practicing for a wedding, and walk you through it and tell you, well, you're going to stand here, then this is going to happen, then the band is going to do this, and then the photographer is going to do that, and then the kids will come with the flowers. So when it happens for real, it's okay. Whether you've been in Judaism rituals comforting others, or whether it's your turn to be comforted, that you understand what the expectations are and what the roles are, and it feels, for people who are used to it, both comfortable and familiar. And it's almost like you were able to relax and let the ritual carry you along, let the community carry you along. And that seems to be helpful for people. When you have a disconnection when somebody has been missing at sea and then you find their body is located a week later or 2 weeks later or something, then sometimes they've gone through the mourning ritual without the body, and that can be hard for them to put the two together. If somebody passes away right before a Jewish holiday, if somebody dies in the morning, they're buried in the afternoon, and then let's say Passover starts or Rosh Hashanah starts or something like that, then the Shiva is canceled. The Shiva begins, you have an hour, you have 5 hours of Shiva, people may come, and then that week of connection is not present. There's many reasons why that is the way that the Orthodox Jewish tradition structures it, but psychologically, it is very difficult for these people because the interconnection, the person's coming to listen to you or to be silent and sit with you, those are not part of the ritual because the ritual has been detoured by a greater trumping card of Jewish holiday trumps individual mourning, the Jewish Sabbath trumps the public expression of grief. You can be grieving, but the Sabbath is to be respected, and people don't generally go in and visit on the Jewish Sabbath if they're of a traditional bent. But psychologically, it's hard. It's hard for people. And so anytime that ritual is disturbed, you find out why it's important, because it creates problems. People, many of the Jews who came to Israel from Ethiopia, the Syrians who came to Greece from Syria, they're losing people. They don't have time to do any grief. There's no ritual involved that is present in time. And then they're left with a very mixed bag of emotions where they have not been cradled by their community. They haven't been helped by their community. There was no public recognition. They had to move on. The research is quite clear on how painful that can be and with what deleterious effects it has over time.
Your example of the kibbutzim reminds me of how many times I hear from my friends in Brooklyn who are not observant that, gee, wouldn't it be nice to have a ritual for who knows what, right? Certainly death, but various transitions of all kinds, professional, personal, what have you. And I spent a lot of time with Jewish socialists here because it is Brooklyn after all. And they frequently say a line that I know has been repeated many times, which is, there's no such thing as a socialist funeral. And I don't know who said that first, but it's something that comes up frequently because for many of these ardently secular Jewish friends, they recognize, even in their secularism, even in their, let's say, antipathy perhaps for religion, there's a human need for ritual. And I, you know, say that not only to my truly secular friends, but also even to members of my Reform synagogue who might not be inclined to observe Shiva because they aren't that observant and we're Reformed, so we don't do that kind of thing. And I, of course, accept whatever anyone is interested in, but we talk frequently about the importance of ritual on a human level, not just from a Jewish perspective or a halachic perspective, but because of what you're describing, that many of us might not be inclined to do traditionally observant things, and yet our tradition exists for a reason. And it's not just because a bunch of white guys somewhere in some room decided that these things were important. I am moved by how human and embodied the Jewish mourning practices are. And I want to ask you another question, which is if there are any other practices from other traditions that are not Jewish that have been especially moving to you, that you think are perhaps very effective or interesting at the very least.
I'm reminded of my cousin who called up and said, my sister wants to be cremated. And is this, you know, what does this mean? Can I still sit Shiva for her? And the answer is, yeah, of course, you could do that. But it was like, wow, if we don't do the Jewish tradition, if we do this foreign tradition, does that mean that you're not really Jewishly buried? And you're probably not Jewishly buried, but you're certainly dead and carried over into the next phase of existence. I once ran a group for adolescents when I was on sabbatical in Boston and at Jewish family services, and there were kids, Jewish kids and non-Jewish kids and Catholics and whatnot. And they would just talk about their rituals. One would say, you know, I go to temple and I say Kaddish for my father. And the other one said, well, the family went, we took the ashes of our mom, and we went to the place where we had spent family, and we left together, and we left some ashes here, and then we moved on and put some ashes there, and the distributing of part of that person in different places, I found moving, and it certainly I've used it myself, and I've seen other colleagues use it for burning of a journal or letters or something that was meaningful as a way of saying goodbye, burying things as a way of saying goodbye in places that were meaningful. I used to think that I would leave a lock of my hair in New Hampshire, so I used to hike the White Mountains. And that would be, you know, a little extra piece of mourning ritual besides the rest of me hopefully being buried in the Holy Land. I think what often happens in for people who are members of a particular tradition is that their encounter with the ritual practices of their religion is meaningful, familiar, and comforting. But when you have clients who are coming in and you're trying to think, how can we build a ritual for them that will be meaningful and that will give them a way to transition through a phase, then all traditions are things that one could use and build upon. So I use comparative religion for psychology and sometimes psychology to enhance my understanding and other people's understanding of a certain aspect of religion.
Overwhelmed by the world opening back up? Who says Shabbat has to be a group activity? Whether you live alone or are looking for ways to create more space for yourself, Friday nights with One Table are about making ourselves feel more grounded, reflective, and intentional. One Table has everything you need, from resource guides to financial support to Shabbat rituals that you can tune into on your schedule so you can experience the magic of Shabbat as it feels right for you. Head to onetable.org to see how you can connect to the experience of Shabbat in a way that is entirely your own. You're talking about building on different rituals, and you write about a two-track model of bereavement. I'm wondering if you could summarize that for us and perhaps compare it against traditional thinking about bereavement that you are improving on.
We're Western beings. We think in terms of behavior. We think in terms of what's going on for people. And the question arises is, when is somebody finished grieving? When has somebody finished their mourning? So as logical positivists, we'll say, well, maybe they're finished grief when they no longer cry at night. Maybe they finished their grief when they're no longer unable to give their all to their work. Or maybe they finished their grieving when they go back to dancing and singing with friends. And certainly in the psychological literature, much of the way people have studied response to loss has looked at changes in behavior and how long they occur. How long is depression after bereavement? Who does it affect? How long does it affect them? And when it's gone away, can you now say that the grieving for someone has ended? So for many years within the psychological field of psychology, partly influenced by Sigmund Freud, the idea was that mourning is basically the product of saying goodbye to somebody you cared about, that you were married to someone, you love them deeply, but you remember the times you spent together, and little by little, you say goodbye to different aspects of that relationship. And at the end of that grieving and mourning period, you're ready now to marry someone else or to meet someone else. You have energy, which has been connected to one person, is now freed up to be connected to someone else. That is a heuristic model. It's a model for explaining bereavement. It's a little bit like what I call the economic model of stocks, that when the stocks go down, you better get your money out sooner rather than later, because otherwise it'll all be wasted. So at a certain point, the person you were invested in is not going to be able to cook for you, pick up after you, make sure your hair is combed and stuff like that. So it's time to find someone else who can do those things for you, to find a new husband who will do what's needed. But that's really a very instrumental way of thinking about it. It's a very interesting and partial way of thinking. And the interesting part of what Freud also was saying, though, is that we're in connection to another person, and that connection to another person has to become disconnected, is the way he was originally understood, or when he talks in a much more personal framework about the loss of his daughter. He says, you know, you never forget, you never let go. And this is what love is all about, is you never let go. So I lost my father at a very young age. At what point do you say that you've finished grieving for your father or mourning your father? I mean, it's 66 years later. I'm bereaved of my father in a certain way, but I am not grieving actively for my father because it's been a long time and I've done a lot of different things and I'm a lot older than he was when he passed. But I am connected to my father in Jewish ritual. On the day of his death, I go to synagogue. I will lead the prayers. I will say the Kaddish during the rituals for the East Course service on the Jewish holidays, major Jewish holidays. I will say the East Course prayer for him and for my mother and for my stepfather. And these are ways of maintaining a connection. When I was growing up, it was very clear to me that we, in the Jewish tradition, we have rituals to maintain connection and memorialize people. And that is what I would later call our way of maintaining a continuing bond, a relationship with the person who died. It's inside of us. It's forever. A parent who's lost a kid does not get over it. A parent who's lost a kid will always be connected to their child. Not 100%, but pretty close. And that is something that will always be with them. They will memorialize their children. They will think about them. They may not talk about it too much, but it's a living, ongoing connection. And kids who lose their parents are also connected in ways. And in the 80s and 90s, there was a revolution within psychological thinking from saying that, well, people disconnect from someone who died and then they're open to new connections. Those of us who were studying children who lost parents, with my colleague Dennis Klass, or my colleague Phil Silverman in Boston, and I who was studying mothers who had lost children to sudden infant death, and was interviewing them 6 years later, and they were actively and incredibly connected to the child who died. And these were infants who died up to about a year. My research later in Israel was interviewing parents who had lost children in the military. Later was interviewing siblings who had lost their siblings, and on and on and on. And no matter which group I studied, they were always saying, well, really, you should go and look at my husband, or you should look at my children, or you should look at my grandparents, or how they're grieving. They're all talking about the psychological pain of losing somebody and the way that they maintain in different ways psychological and emotional connections to the people who died. And when I talk about in my work, I say that we need to understand that there's two things going on. The people can be emotionally devastated by loss, or they can be really doing very well by loss and after loss. And those things are important to understand. But there's another part that we will never understand by looking at someone, only by listening to them. And they're listening to themselves. And it is what kind of connection they maintain to the person who died within themselves, when they think about them, what they think when they think about them, what they remember. And that this is an incredibly important part of our human connections. We're connected to people who are alive with us, and we're connected to people who were once alive in our lives and maintain their living presence within us. And like I said, we're all together looking at each other on Zoom, but our emotional connections are with many, many people who are not in the room with us. And many of them are alive, and some of them are no longer alive, but they're still important to our emotional well-being, if you will. My mother carrying me and swaddling me and feeding me are not things that I personally remember, but it's very clear to me that kind of love and care are what allows me to be a functional and competent human being to the extent that I manage that, is that was an incredibly important part, and that she is maintained within me in ways that I can articulate and not articulate. And that's how we all do it. Different ways, different relationships. And the ones that are most important to us are the ones that will be with us forever. And Moses losing Miriam, the sister who cared for him, Moses losing Aaron, his spiritual brother, twin, the one that took him into the Jewish people, whereas he took them into the courts of Egypt. And they kind of really did that lovely balancing and caring for each other and dual leadership. Those are incredibly painful losses in the world, but without a doubt, their interconnection within themselves, that they maintain those memories and sense of connection even after they passed away, as long as they were alive.
I'm wondering, Rabbi Matt, and for you as well, Professor Rubin, if you've encountered any specific wisdom in Torah that's been useful, whether because you're leading a congregation and work in bereavement or in the study of, is there wisdom baked into Torah about how to deal with all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to know what Professor Rubin has to say, but I think that, I mean, the first thing is just simply, again, what we learn in this week's Torah portion, that takes 30 days for the people to mourn Aaron, that it takes time. I mean, some of this is obvious, but I think that I have watched as people don't go through the rituals, and I have watched as some of them are, of course, totally fine, but I have watched people who do go through the rituals find it to be surprisingly meaningful. And so, is there wisdom in Torah? Obviously, yes. I would say that the wisdom really comes out of the fact that our rabbinic tradition has used, whether it is the 30 days of this week's Torah portion, or other ways of coming up with these rituals of Shiva, and then Shloshim, and then the year of mourning, that just are surprisingly useful on a human level. One thing I would throw out there, though, is that we've talked about this idea of 30 days, we've talked about 7 days of Shiva, we've talked about a year a little bit, but one of my favorite things in our tradition about the Jewish mourning practices is that if you're mourning someone, let's say for a year, you're saying Kaddish for your parent, let's say, you don't continue after a year. And some would say you don't continue after 11 months, which comes from a custom around, you know, honoring a person and saying they don't actually need that extra month because they were holy enough by themselves or they weren't sinful. But I love the idea that you take the time to do the thing, but then you got to stop. At some point, there must be some way, even ritually, of recognizing it's time to move on.
Hmm. I think that I'm probably more hesitant to take that forward. I think that there are pressures in life that take us both away. I'm going to get to the question of the Judaism part in a second. There is a lovely story about a researcher, a Swedish researcher, who was studying Muslim response to bereavement in Bali, and there was this woman who lost her boyfriend, her fiance, and he died. And she was basically met by people who were telling her how lucky she was that he died and what a jerk he was. And that it was really a great thing that she was not going to get married. And then about a year and some later, she was engaged to marry someone else. And these same people came over and told her how sad it was that her fiance had passed, the first fiance had passed. And the way that this was interpreted by the researcher, Professor Wicken, was that they were scared. The people in Bali were scared that the grief over the loss of her fiance would drive her over to be dysfunctional. And so they were doing what they could to separate her as quickly as possible from her boyfriend, her fiance. But once they were assured that she was back on a life track, they could go and rejoin her and allow her to and grieve in a way when they were believed that she was in a safer place. It's not my tradition. It's not many people I know's tradition, but it was something that was very interesting about a cultural way of trying to figure out how to balance being with life and being pained about death. And I think that that's an important question. And there's something about the ritual ending, which I think is important. And there's something about the fact that we will remain connected forever that is something that needs to be at least made space for. We can talk about that another time or in the next world. What I take away from Judaism is what I understand about God's creation of human beings and the way that the story is related in Genesis, that the human being is created, and each person is their own world, and they're irreplaceable, that we are each other's siblings, that all people are valuable, and that there's such the idea that man is created and woman is created in God's image allows us to appreciate the value and of what it means to be a human being and what it means to lose someone for people who are close to them. And even when you're understanding people that you were reading about that understand that they were important and what a loss it is to lose any human being on our planet is what I take away from Judaism. And it's less ritual, but it's I think of it as an important ethical message.
I'm curious because, you know, the pandemic has taken millions of lives across the world in an impossibly short amount of time. Has your perspective on bereavement changed in any way as a response to that?
Many things about the bereavement during the pandemic are—I wouldn't say have been changed, but I see all the problems that losing people during the pandemic, when you couldn't be close to the people you cared about, when you were at best ensconced in some sort of protective gear and didn't have the luxury really of just a human touch. Those are incredibly difficult ways to go, to be unable to travel for whether it's 10 minutes or 10 hours, to be with family, to grieve together in person, has, I think, exacted a cost that we will see later over time in forms of emotional difficulties that follow bereavements that don't have a more salutary course, that people didn't get to sit Shiva and didn't get to be together. People are isolated from many of people. And even as much as we've learned to, if we're fortunate and wealthy, to be able to use the computer and to be in partial contact, it is partial and not in ways that we have learned over the years. So that is sad. And there's one piece in also in today's this weekend's Parsha, which is the plague that affects the Jewish people. And there's something about plague that is very difficult, and it really makes you deal with massive losses. And at a time, it's really very different than dealing with an individual loss when one's family is grieving, but nobody else's family is grieving. There's a lot of emotional, perhaps, access that they can give to supporting. But if everybody is grieving and everybody is in a difficult place, there's just much less community resilience to support those in need of it.
I mean, odds are some of our listeners are in mourning due to the last year. If you could leave us with any practical guidance based on the work that you've done, what would you say?
One of the things that I try to teach and try to share is that saying goodbye to someone is not something that needs to be done before they die. That there's much time following death to rework relationships, to do a process of separation. There's enough people who go to grave sites and speak to the ones they love, including Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon 4, I think it is. So if it's out there in public, you know, in culture, popular culture, you know, it's something that happens. But that to not let death exert its finality, but to understand that death is really something that interferes with our connection to people, but it does not stop it, and that there are many ways to figure out how to reconnect. Those people believe in an afterlife and believe that the soul of their person that they love is out there, find it and perhaps a little bit easier. But even if you believe that death is the end of a connection, that there are many ways to find, to be creative. I guess the literature, popular literature has a lot of suggestions about that, but to not fall into the trap of thinking that death stops you from changing, from saying goodbye, from apologizing, or any of those things. It does not. It just makes it different.
Professor Simon Shimshon Rubin, it is a great honor to speak with you, and thank you so much for taking some time to help unpack this week's Torah portion and help us just get a better understanding of bereavement in total, as well as through the Jewish lens. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me, and I was honored to be here with you.
Thanks so much, Rabbi Matt Green. Thanks for joining for another week of Torah study.
Thanks, Raviv, and thank you, Professor. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
To all of our listeners, Shabbat Shalom. Check it out. Seems like yesterday we used to rock the show. I laced the track, you locked the flow. So far from hanging. The study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host today was Rabbi Matt Green, and our guest was Professor Simon Shimshon Rubin. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week. In the future, can't wait to see if you open up the gates for me. Reminisce sometime the night they took my friend.